So let's look in detail at the first page of the document by Andrew Carnegie. And the question that we always ask each other first is, who is he writing for? Well, the whole content of the document is what you should do if you are a millionaire. Now, and this is published in the North American Review. Now, I'm sure you realise that there are no magazines which are only written for millionaires. There's not enough millionaires to read them. But certainly, this kind of review with long, quite intellectual articles like that, I think it's fair to say that he's writing for a middle-class audience. Yeah, he's not writing like Tom Paine. These are the times that try men's souls. Yeah, it's not supposed to inspire the masses. That's not the problem. The problem is to explain to the elite of society in the broader sense, quite a lot of people. And indeed, document will later be included in a book a couple of years later. No, not even a couple of years later. Later on that year, it will be included in a book called The Gospel of Wealth. So, June 1889, so the time of monopoly capitalism. I will come to some of the specific events in Carnegie's life in a moment. But let's have a look at this title, The Gospel of Wealth, which is the title. He mentions at the very end of the document, he says, this is the true gospel of wealth. So the title of this article is Wealth. But when they reproduce it in the book, they will call it The Gospel of Wealth. And that is a very interesting title. Who wrote the original gospel? Anybody? Have you got an idea? The apostles, yeah. Not all of them were apostles, but some of them were apostles. How many people wrote the gospels? Yes?
Four.
Four, yes. Oh, you got the names? No, Peter didn't.
John,
no. Yeah?
John Matthew. Mark?
Yes.
And
who was the fourth gospel? Luke. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four eventually. And now I say this, although in fact there were more gospels, but in 500 or something they threw half of them away. But yeah, anyway, the four well-known gospels are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they tell the story of wealth and how to be a millionaire. No, they don't, do they? No, not at all. Yes. So it's very interesting. He talks about the gospel of wealth. The gospel, and you think, oh yes, we know the gospel. It's about the story of Jesus. And he didn't say, the first thing you have to do is get rich. Not at all. And in fact, this is still a very Christian society. So Carnegie has a little bit of a problem because, you know, that's like, you know, you can easily imagine how you can be worried about how you should be rich or how to be a Christian. But he wants to put them together, the gospel of wealth. And so this is a very ambitious title. Yeah, it's not, you know, what I did with my money and some advice for you. It's the gospel of wealth. Now, the gospel was a book which really did transform history and transform society for hundreds of years. And so he's suggesting, you know, my ideas are pretty big. Yeah, very, very ambitious. I am the richest man in the world, listen to me. Yeah. So the gospel of wealth. And indeed, a little later, he will say, he will reject the old view of Christianity, imitate the life of Jesus, which means being poor and not eating pizza. No, Jesus didn't mention pizza, forget that one. Now, of course, it has been a long time that Christians were not necessarily interested in imitating the life of Jesus. But he puts it down on paper. He says, our new society needs a new Christian ethic. And the new Christian ethic is, one, get rich. Two, help other people to help themselves. And this was the idea of Carnegie's philanthropy. He said, you know, give away your money if you're rich. But don't give it away as charity. Indeed, he says a little later in this document, of every $1,000 which is given away in charity, $950 are badly spent. When you walk down the streets and you give $5 to the beggar, you are doing a bad thing which will harm society and which will harm the beggar. This is not my opinion. This is Carnegie's opinion. You got that. A certain originality. He's saying that on the one hand, you know, don't give charity. Don't just give people money. But because that sounds rather harsh, he's saying you must help people to help themselves. And this is the idea of libraries. Yeah, libraries in poor parts of town. The Carnegie Trust, I think, founded in total 8,000 libraries. And as I say, I am well placed to understand that these are very important things. As I say, you need a special piece of imagination to be a historian today before the internet, yes. So let's have a look at the very first section here. Some other examples he gives of philanthropy being good. Charity is bad, in his opinion. Philanthropy is good, and he gives another example, parks. It was not unusual in the 19th century, was not common, but in Britain and the United States, the public parks were often given by rich people to the town. Certainly, and they have the name of the person, I mean, where I come from, all of that. This was tremendously important. Once we had discovered urban life, the idea was that, workers need on a Sunday, so they work Saturdays, there was need on a workers on a Sunday to have a beautiful place to relax. And this was part of philanthropy. The other thing that they built, especially in Britain, was concert halls. In every town they built concert halls, and they had classical music concerts, 1 penny the ticket. Very, very cheap. Classical music for the workers. Now, of course, on the one hand, this could be a little bit patronising. You poor people, you don't listen to enough classical music. That's why you're so stupid. But on the other hand, it was also very popular. A large number of workers were very interested to go to these very cheap concerts. And of course, we still see things like that today. So those are some of the examples we give. But let me come to the specific text at the beginning here. The problem of our age is the proper administration of wealth, so that the ties of brotherhood may still bind together the rich and poor in harmonious relationship. Okay. Doit au but, j'aime bien ça. And it reminds me a little bit of when you have an interview with a politician, and the politician says, what do you think of this? And the politician answers, the most important question is, because if you're going to communicate, you have to make sure that you are posing what is the most important question. I'm going to tell you what the most important question is. And that's what he does at the beginning. He says, the problem of our age. The thing we need to sort out is how to administer wealth so that the rich and the poor are not in conflict, but love each other. Of course, you could answer, well, that might be your opinion of the problem of our age. And of course, the Knights of Labour would say, no, not at all. The problem of the age is to get rid of poverty. And the communists, who he's going to mention on the next, says, oh, no, the problem of our age is to take the riches away from the rich and control society in a different way. So, of course, you say de bonne guerre, chacun sa problem of our age. And so he begins by the rhetorical device is to define the problem. Say, what is the priority? Notice the inharmonious relationship. Now, this is the 1880s in the United States. There has just been, I haven't got the exact date, but in the 1880s there is an enormous strike in Chicago, in Haymarket, and there are a number of people killed. Even today in Chicago, every year they commemorate the Haymarket martyrs. It's very ambitious what he's saying. Rich and poor should live in harmony. It's not looking that way. And in particular, the life of Carnegie as a industrialist will be a life quite complicated, because at one point he will say, it's important that workers should be free to join trade unions. And his millionaire's friend, was it, you're mad? No, we're against trade unions. But he has this idea. However, as there is more and more conflict, he will be involved in very vicious strikes to break the trade unions. Indeed, the biggest one will be in 1892 at Homestead. It was good, wasn't it? Yeah, at Homestead. What will happen is the Knights of Labour will be involved. They will be organising the trade union. There's a big strike. Carnegie has a problem because he is famous. He is well known as the man who speaks about the importance of harmony between the rich and the poor. And the fact that workers have the right to join a trade union. But here you have a really big conflict. And so what does he do? He goes on holiday to Scotland and he stays out of the way and out of communication with the newspapers while his manager brings in the militia to fight against the workers. Now, the militia involved is the Pinkerton's National Detective Agency. Is not actually a detective agency. It's an organisation which the bosses pay to come with arms to break the strikes. Now, in fact, what will happen in Homestead is very, very dramatic because the militia, the Pinkerton militia, will arrive. And at the end, I think there are 7 workers killed and 3 Pinkertons killed. That's a big deal. 14 hours of gunfight. The workers win the battle and they make all the Pinkertons leave, most of them with broken arms. But Frick, who is Carnegie's manager, will win the strike, and there will be no trade union in the in that town for 45 years in the steel industry. So we've got a situation where Carnegie is in a contradictory situation. On the one hand, he has idealistic things to say, and on the other hand, his position as a monopoly capitalist leads him to be on one side in very violent conflicts, in particular in Homestead. I'll come back to that in a moment. So this is all about the harmonious relationship. Now, what he's going to do in the next few paragraphs is he's going to describe the rise of industrial society. He's going to describe the rise of industrial society, how it happened, what the difference is, and whether it is a good thing or a bad thing. And he's going to say it's a good thing. Interestingly enough, it's quite comparable in some ways to the Communist Manifesto. The Communist Manifesto also begins by explaining how capitalism arose, and also Karl Marx says the arrival of capitalism was a good thing compared with what happened before. But the difference between them, of course, is that Carnegie believes that the present 19th century American economic and society is the end of the story. It's the best. We've got to the best place. Whereas Karl Marx will be saying we need to go to a future society which is different. So let's see in more detail how Carnegie puts that together. He's going to talk in general about the changes in society over the centuries. The conditions of human life have not only been changed but revolutionized within the past few hundred years. In former days, there was little difference between the dwelling, dress, food, and environment of the chief and those of his retainers, his workers. The Indians, he means the Native Americans, the Indians are today where civilized men then was. When visiting the Sioux, I was led to the wigwam of the chief. It was just like the others in external appearance. And even within, the difference was trifling between it and those of the poorest of his braves, his Indians. The contrast between the palace of the millionaire and the cottage of the labourer with us today measures the change which has come with civilization. He claims that this big difference between rich and poor is new. And from a historian's point of view, this is no doubt true, no doubt generally true. You know that when a historian says recently, they mean 300 years ago. We do that. We look at long periods. Now, this also is similar to what Karl Marx says, because Marx in the Communist Manifesto says that human beings have been on the planet for 4 or 5 million years, but the difference between rich and poor is 4 or 5 thousand years old, a very, very short period. So it's not, he's not saying exactly the same thing, but there's some reflection. And so he is saying that one of the changes is that there was not much inequality in the past. However, he is going to say that this inequality is a good thing, because in the past, people were, in his opinion, people were more or less equal, but hungry. And today, everybody is better off. There is some truth in this. You know, we haven't had a famine in France since 1820, I think, but I'm not absolutely sure. So that's good. Famine's not good. Yeah. So that's good. And so there he is talking about the contrast between the palace of the millionaire and the cottage of the labourer. Et encore, il est un peu idéaliste. I showed you a picture just a few pictures ago. Yep. The cottage of the labourer. Il serait bien content d'avoir un cottage, hein? So he's being a little bit, he's using a little poetic license, but certainly the poor working conditions of the labourer. And he realises that some people will say, oh yes, this inequality is terrible, and so he's going to tell us why he thinks that this inequality is good. Necessary. Whereas Karl Marx will say the inequality was necessary for a certain period of time. Carnegie will say it's always necessary. This change, however, is not to be deplored, but welcomed as highly beneficial. It is well, nay, essential for the progress of the race, that the houses of some should be homes for all that is highest and best in literature and the arts, and for all the refinements of civilization, rather than that none should be so. So it is essential for the progress of the race to have some very rich people who are also very cultured, who defend art and great music, and so on, philosophy, and so on. And so it's better to have some people doing this than nobody. Of course, he doesn't consider it possible for everybody to have it. Notice that line 10, we mustn't get confused here, he talks about progress of the race. Il faut lire la race humaine, et pas la race blanche, ici, dans ce contexte. So the race, that's just the norm, the race in general, yeah. Indeed, there is a worker's song, a woman's liberation song from many, many years ago. The rising of the women is the rising of the race. Yeah. But they don't mean the white race, they mean the human race, yeah. So, much better this great irregularity than universal squalor. Without wealth, there can be no Mycenas. The good old times were not good old times. Neither master nor servant was as well situated then as today. A relapse to old conditions would be disastrous to both, not least to him who serves, and would sweep away civilization with it. So although there is inequality, everybody is better off. And so if Carnegie was around today, he would say, yeah, there's inequality, but you know, think about your grandparents. They didn't have sushi and they didn't have mobile phones. That's pretty sad. There is some reason to his argument that today, I mean, if we take today because you know today, yeah, although there are many, many problems in the world, nevertheless, even ordinary people today, of course there are some very poor people, ordinary people today often have a mobile phone and sushi, which is fun. And also, you know, you can, if you want to listen to music from China. If I say, I want to listen to music from China, it will take you 30 seconds with your phone to find me some music from China. And he's going to say something similar, but about his society. He's going to say, it is incredible. We have a million times more things than people dreamt of a few hundred years ago. And now, of course, on est souvent le nez dans le guidon, donc on est parfois moins optimiste. Ah oui, 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 oui. Le sushi n'est pas aussi bon que c'était l'année dernière. Okay, but he's being very positive about it. But whether the change be for good or ill, it is upon us, beyond our power to alter, and therefore it must be accepted and made the best of. It is a waste of time to criticize the inevitable. Okay, now he's speaking because in the 19th century there are people who say, oh, yeah, industry causes such horrible conditions. Look at the poverty in New York. It would be nice to go back to life in the village in the old way. You okay to eat this today. And Carnegie says that it's impossible to go back. Yeah? And saying, oh, it would be nice if we all lived in villages and made our clothes by hands, in his opinion. It's a waste of time. You're talking about something which cannot happen. And again, you know, you're allowed to agree or disagree, but he does have some reasons to say this. You know, if I take this group of students here and I put you back in a village from 300 years ago, well, you'll just all die because you're such bad farmers. I think you would. We're just not good at this anymore. Also, I would miss the pizza. Okay. He's now going to look at the question of how did industrial capitalism arrive? It arrived. It brought great inequality. This inequality is, well, it's inevitable. But in many ways, for Carnegie, it's good. So he's going to look at how he's arrived. Again, this is very much parallel to the Communist Manifesto, who he looks. How did capitalism arrive? And one of the things he says is that that Marx says that capitalism is permanent revolution. All that is solid melts into air. Everything we consider decided and fixed forever will be completely transformed. And in Karl Marx's text, he says, all emotions disappear, all traditional links of loyalty disappear in front of the power of money. Now, he's not going to say the same thing here, isn't Carnegie, but he's going to say, it is easy to see how the change has come. One illustration will serve for almost every phase of the cause. In the manufacture of products, we have the whole story. So the center of the change, in Carnegie's opinion, is the change in manufacture. And we can see this. I'm wearing a very pretty shirt. This was not made, all right, okay, a mediocre shirt. But this shirt was not made by my personal tailor, thinking about my personal size and my personal tastes. It was that. You can get shirts made individually. And they're expensive. This was probably made in China, sold by, well, I'm not going to tell you who it was sold by. And so the change between the cost of making a shirt by one person, who probably makes a very good shirt, and buying a shirt, you know, whether it's cheap or expensive, it's enormous. Yeah, the price is like, you know, very, this is not only the case for clothes, there are also something else. If you look at your mobile phone, because occasionally people say, oh, it's wonderful to have handmade clothes. You get a few people who think, oh, it's wonderful to have handmade clothes. Nobody wants a handmade mobile telephone. Yeah. So, yeah, I have a friend who's, he was trained by Japanese people, and he will make you no, thank you. Yeah, many of the things which are very important to us and which are very useful to us can only be made in factories. And this was already the case at the time, a sewing machine. You try and make a sewing machine as an artisan, Yeah, you're just not going to manage it. Yeah. And so this is what he's saying here. That in the manufacture of products, we have the whole story. It applies to all combinations of human industry as stimulated and enlarged by the inventions of this scientific age. And in fact, today, if you happen to like to have your shirts made by hand, the best way to do it is, first of all, find the website of somebody who makes shirts by hand. And the person making shirts by hand will receive an email demanding it, then use the electricity to be able to see his handmade shirts. So in many ways today, you actually do not have any handmade products. They're all dependent on the industry. Even like I say, I mean, that's really true. If you want to make a living making shirts by hand, you need a website. You really need a website. Yeah. And so, you know, it's just the whole thing has changed. We can't go back. Now he's going to go back, he's going to look at the past of industry, the past of manufacture. Sometimes economists make a difference between manufacture and industry. Manufacture being making things at home, facture made by hand, yeah? And industry in the factories. So let's look at the past of the manufacture, and he's going to give a realistic and ordinary picture. Formerly, articles were manufactured at the domestic hearth or in small shops which formed part of the household. The master and his apprentices worked side by side, the latter living with the master and therefore subject to the same conditions. Now he's talking about a few hundred years ago. He's actually talking about a few hundred years ago in Britain. Yeah, the beginning of a modern market economy. He's not talking about America, because 300 years before they had a traditional society which was not involved in a market. There was not a market. So this is the very beginnings of capitalism, where the master, the capitalist, the small capitalist, has four people who are making shirts for him. Let's sit with the shirts. And this is absolutely true. They will eat with him. They hope to become a master themselves. They will marry his daughters, yeah, etc. That's one of the wonderful things about cities. You get a bit more choice. And this is what he's saying. When these apprentices rose to be masters, there was little or no change in their mode of life, and they, in turn, educated in the same routine, succeeding apprentices. There was substantially social equality. Now he's talking about in the area of production. That is, that the capitalist and his four employees were more or less equal in 1700, in 1750. That's generally true. Now notice he's not talking about society in general. In society in general, though, the aristocracy, the big landowners, and that was not social equality, but within industry, within the manufacture of products, in particular shirts, this is what was going on. And indeed, he goes on. There was substantially social equality and even political equality, for those engaged in industrial pursuits had then little or no political voice in the states. For many hundreds of years, Parliament was full, in Britain, was full of landowners. And if you were a small worker working for a small master, you couldn't vote. And if you were a small master, you often couldn't vote as well. You remember I mentioned when we spoke about the speech of Macaulay, that for hundreds of years, when Manchester became more and more a manufacturing centre, they still didn't have a Member of Parliament. So the factory owner and the factory workers did not have a Member of Parliament. But, this is Carnegie's opinion, the inevitable result of such a mode of manufacture was crude articles at high prices. So one of the reasons he doesn't want to go back to the old way of working at home and small groups of workers is that it gave, in his opinion, crude articles at high prices. Now, high prices seems to be a fact. Yeah, if you make shirts by hand, or indeed chairs, it's slightly unusual that he should say crude articles. Perhaps he's being a bit biased there, because there are many reasons to think that the clothes which were made in the traditional way were often very, not crude, they were highly skilled workers. And the ceramics, for example, yeah, the traditional ceramists and traditional furniture makers, well, they didn't make crude articles. Indeed, today, especially in the middle class, people say, oh yeah, factory-made furniture is cheap, but it's not good. Yeah, no, most of us buy our furniture at IKEA. But if we have more money, we might think we could get something prettier if there is an artisan involved. Yeah. Or occasionally we get a very nice piece of furniture left to us by our grandparents or something. But it's true, that's gone out. I mean, you know, the IKEA is an incredible story. It's like a huge percentage of furniture comes from IKEA, you know, which it's good and it's cheap. But whereas perhaps your grandparents, like my mother, she's 90, she has one or two, a working class woman, has one or two really nice old furniture. Really nice old furniture. There you go. I'm now telling you the story of my mother's furniture. That's not the question. Okay. Today, the world obtains commodities of excellent quality at prices which even the generation preceding this would have deemed incredible. This is still the case today. I have here my watch. It is a Swatch watch, so it's not the cheapest. But if you want a cheap watch, you can get a watch for €10 on Amazon. When I was 12 years old, I was given my first watch, which was a mechanical watch. It wasn't millions, but it was a big deal. You had a watch, and you showed your friends, "I've got a watch." You don't do it today. You say, "Look, I've got a okay." It's not going to work anyway. So even at the time, these are in a way sentiments which we can relate to because things are still changing so quickly. That is to say that Carnegie says that monopoly capitalism makes things change very quickly. And this is still the case 130 years later. When you listen to your parents talking about life before mobile phones and how hard it was. Yeah. Okay. In the commercial world, similar causes have produced similar results and the races benefited thereby. So first of all, he talks about industry. And how today, with factories, we make things so much cheaper and often of good quality. This is true. I mean, the sewing machines are of good quality. Most today, in the 21st century, most cars that you buy new are of good quality. They don't make really bad cars. That's why they need to advertise so hard. Yeah, because there's no huge difference, really. And now he talks about the commercial world. Because the commercial world, the buying and selling, and he's talking about a few hundred years, and again, everything has been completely transformed. Because in 1600, if you wanted to buy something, you could go to the village shop, or you could go to the village shop. There's one shop. Or you could walk for 5 or 6 hours to the next shop. So it's very, very small, and you can imagine. But when Carnegie is writing, this is a pro. Now I'm not very good on the exact dates, but I suspect that this is about the same time that Zola is writing Au Bonheur des Dames, which is a novel about the first department stores in Paris. And this is also the time of the beginnings of Harrods and the other one. The very famous department store in Britain. And you can imagine again that this is something that would impress people. You know, the people who came from Montluçon and came to Paris and saw the Galerie Lafayette in 1890, they were really impressed. It was really something else. Even people wanted to read Zola novels about it. So that's pretty wild. So just like in the industrial world, the commercial world has revolutionized the way that things are produced and sold. And this is also very much about the railways. Because if things are cheaper, it's because also very much because transport is cheaper. And the railways can take stuff which is made in New York and Washington and take it to sell it in Portland. for not very high prices. The poor enjoy what the rich could not before afford. What were the luxuries have become the necessaries of life. The labourer has now more comforts than the landlord had a few generations ago. The farmer has more luxuries than the landlord had and is more richly clad and better housed. The landlord has books and pictures rarer and appointments more artistic than the king could then obtain. Just notice that here in this sentence, appointments means decorations. Now, in this paragraph, you can see that he is repeating himself. We had a couple of more. Now, he's repeating himself because he wants to underline how important it is. This is a rhetorical device to repeat yourself in different words. It's nothing surprising. And he said, again, the farmer has what the landlord used to have. The landlord has what the king used to have. Okay, I'm complete, huh? But he's waxing lyrical about it. And certainly that continues to be the case today. Because although you may have heard in history lessons about the great library of Alexandria, which was the best library in the history of humanity, except that your mobile phone is better. So there really are incredible transformations going on there. Now he's going to look at the negative side. There's always a negative side. And I think, in my opinion, today we live in quite a cynical age, and we're quite often underline the negative. There are good reasons for this, but there are things still going on which are very impressive. The price we pay for this salutary change, now a salutary change is a good change. It's a good change. The price we pay for this salutary change is no doubt great. So, what is the negative? What is the downside? He's going to tell us, in his opinion, what is the downside. And interestingly enough, what he says is very similar to what Karl Marx says. I'm sure he's read Karl Marx. Rich people read Marx more than poor people, actually. And it's very similar to what Karl Marx says in the Communist Manifesto. We assemble thousands of operatives in the factories, in the mine, and in the counting house, of whom the employer can know little or nothing, and to whom the employer is little better than a myth. All conversation between them is at an end. In this sentence, intercourse means social relations in general, and nothing more rude. Rigid castes are formed, and as usual, mutual ignorance breeds mutual distrust. Each caste is without sympathy for the other and ready to credit anything disparaging in regard to it. Under the law of competition, the employer of thousands is forced into the strictest economies, among which the rates paid to labour figure prominently. And often there is friction between the employer and the employed, between capital and labour, between rich and poor. Human society loses homogeneity. Okay, so the negative side is, in contrast, a few hundred years ago, the capitalist knew his workers, they had dinner together. And today this is impossible because the factories are so huge. And also, and in the opinion of Cargany, it's a bad thing. They don't understand each other anymore. And this is because of ignorance, that they don't know about each other. So and ignorance breeds mutual distrust. They don't trust each other because they don't really know each other. Now, this is Carnegie's view on this. This is where we'll get to. The Knights of Labour would say no. The reason they distrust each other is because they have a real conflict of interest. And from the point of view of the Knights of Labour, everything the boss wins has actually been taken from us. It's like we made the products and the boss stole the money. That's the Knights of Labour opinion. Whereas Carnegie, from the very beginning, he says it is possible for rich people to love poor people and poor people to love rich people. That's possible. And so he sees the friction, he mentions friction, as a bad thing which can be avoided. And he's going to explain how, in his opinion, it can be avoided. Now, he does seem to minimize the situation. I mean, he says, oh, there is sometimes friction. Yes, the militia come and kill some workers, and then the workers burn the trains. And friction, yeah, it's friction. You know, it's like Hamlet had a relationship problem with his uncle. You know, it's very much read down. Ce qui est de bonne guerre, c'est entre dans son argument. Yeah, so certainly when he talks about friction, because we know that the story where, you know, that it was not unusual for, well, in the Homestead strike, seven workers were killed and three of the Pinkertons who were sent to break the strike. So today in modern France, it's very rare for people to die in a strike. It does happen. I think there was a case about 6 or 7 years ago, but it's not typical, which I think is generally a good thing. I'm not generally in favour of people dying. So human society loses homogeneity. Where in the past people were equal, now they are very unequal. And he points out that the law of competition will oblige capitalists to reduce wages, to keep wages low. So he's going to continue here with the reflection that it has costs, but it is inevitable. The price which society pays for the law of competition, like the price it pays for cheap comforts and luxuries, is also great. But the advantage of the law of competition are greater still. For it is to this law that we owe our wonderful material development, which brings improved conditions in its train. But whether the law of competition be benign or not, we must say of it, as we say of the change in the conditions of men to which we have referred, it is here, the law of competition is here. We cannot evade it. No substitutes for the law of competition have been found. And while the law may sometimes be hard for the individual, it is best for the human race, because it ensures the survival of the fittest in every department. The survival of the fittest. We have a bit of a key phrase there. The survival of the fittest. Does this make you think of any other writer? The survival of the fittest. He is quoting another writer, or two other writers. This all comes from Charles Darwin. Here I have to explain a little bit what is social Darwinism. So first of all, what is Darwinism? Darwinism is the incredible scientific advance made by an English person, yeah, in the middle of the 19th century, where Charles Darwin publishes two books. The first one, The Origin of Species, which shows how, in fact, although the birds looked very different, in fact, if you go back far enough, they all come from the same animal. And the changes are due to them adapting to their environment. And indeed, you go back further, and all the animals from one animal, and then all the animals from one plant, right back millions of years, of course. This is very controversial at the time, because people commonly think that the Earth was created 4,000 years ago. I have an old 19th century Bible at home, and at the side, when it says God created the earth, it gives you the date, 4,000 years ago, on the 7th of October. Really? And this is the 19th century, it's not a 12th century. So Charles Darwin demonstrates that that evolution works towards the survival of the fittest species. Now, this is important. So, for example, if you have an island which is very green, and then the climate gets hotter, and it's not green anymore, it's brown. The green birds have a problem. They were very successful, the green birds, when the island was green, because the predators couldn't see them. But now the island is brown, the green birds lose because they're not the fittest for this environment. However, in the second book, The Ascent of Man, he will apply the same ideas to human beings and say, yeah, you all used to be monkeys. Yeah. This was very... The reason he waited 20 years to publish his second book is because he was a very religious man and he was frightened of upsetting his religious friends and family to talk, because to talk about animals was one thing. About human beings, it was a bit shaky. Now, 20 years later, Herbert Spencer invents social Darwinism. Now, social Darwinism, in fact, has no connection with Charles Darwin and is a misuse of his theory, because Charles Darwin's theory says, why are the green birds no longer successful? It's about competition between species, the green birds and the brown birds, if you like. Whereas Herbert Spencer talks about the competition between individuals, which is completely different. And Herbert Spencer says, why are rich people rich? Because they're the best people. Why are poor people poor? Because they deserve to be poor. This is social Darwinism. But in fact, it wasn't Charles Darwin's fault. Yeah, it's just they use the idea. And this is what he's saying here, that in society, the law of competition leads to the survival of the fittest in every area. And this is why he writes his other book, How to Get Rich. If you are the cleverest, if you are the one who gets the boss to notice you and finds the clever way of cornering the market, then you will be successful, and that's because you are the best. If you have a million diplomas, you can be a university professor, and we're the best. So it's a similar sort of idea. At least we think we are. We think we are the best. So the survival of the fittest, this is social Darwinism, and the person we're talking about is Herbert Spencer. Okay, so the last thing I want to say is that, so in this document in general, the richest man in the world is giving his view of how modern industrial society, capitalism at the end of the 19th century in the United States, how it came, why it is a good thing, and what are the ways it could be improved. In particular, what should the millionaires do? And he's going to say, well, millionaires, they could give to charity, but that's bad. You just encourage laziness. Millionaires, they could give their money to their children, inheritance. That's bad. Yeah. So the best thing to do is philanthropy, and that is to give the money to the community in order to help people to help themselves. So you don't raise wages. I'm saying you're not millionaires. They don't raise wages. And they don't give money to people who are hungry. But they build libraries, they build parks. They invest in, schools and universities. And that is still very much the case. Now, philanthropy is even more important in the United States than here. But if you go to the Louvre and you see a big exhibition, it will say, that a lot of the money comes from this company. It's an idea that, if this is Citroën is funding, they're not really doing it because they'll make much money out of it. It's more about image. But it's a real thing, and it's real money. It's a lot of money. Now, it has to be said that this the vision of Andrew Carnegie, the individualist solution, how to get rich and what to do with your money, this is not surprising. There are a lot of writers telling you individual solutions at the time, and one of the greatest is a British gentleman called Samuel Smiles, and he wrote this bestseller called Self-Help at the end of the 19th century, towards the end of the 19th century. Now, you may not have heard of this, but you see, in fact, on the left you have the translation to French. It was written in English in England. On the left you have the translation to French, and on the right you have a modern version from today. This was huge. They did a survey around the beginning of the 20th century in people's homes. The most common book they could find in people's homes was the Bible. Okay, fair enough, yeah, good story. The second most common book was Fox's Book of Martyrs, a Protestant religious book. This was number three. Samuel Smiles' Self-Help was the third one. It was huge. It was absolutely huge. And this was a time when, you know, people had five books in the house and houses, and this was number three. He went, and he tells what, you know, yes?
Is the idea closely linked to the idea of God helps those who help?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I'm sure he says that 23 times in there, absolutely. He wrote some other books as well. Oh, that's the Spanish version. He also wrote this book, Samuel Sayles' book, this book, Thrift, il faut traduire, comment être économe. Yeah, comment être économe, thrift. So, you know, it's very much the same sort of idea. The solution is individual. If you're poor, you need to think about how to use your individual initiative to move forward. So this is, you know, how to save money. Now, of course, there are always horrible communist people like me to say that telling poor people to save their money is a bit of an insult. It's obviously easier to do thrift. So I've more or less come to the end there. And of course, the important thing is not to denounce Carnegie. It doesn't matter who we denounce. It's to understand where he's coming from. But also, I think it's fair to point out that his picture of some unfortunate friction between workers and bosses because they don't understand each other is, let's say, a vision which fits him. It's de bonne guerre, but it comes from his particular particular experience. Thank you very much for listening so carefully.